I'll stop talking.
No, it's fine. You can finish. Go ahead.
I grew up in those states and worked for the steel industry, so I traveled relocation and so forth. So I know Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Michigan.
Uh-huh. How about that? Well, that's interesting, because I couldn't figure out what you had in common with those states. It didn't seem like a lot in common, but that's good that you got people on the ground that can track things down for you.
Oh, yeah, and interested in investing with me.
Yeah. And what kind of properties are you looking for?
Well, single-family residence.
Any particular technique you're trying to use?
What I learned from the Goins Group.
Okay. Any particular one, though, like Filthy Riches, is that what you're looking for, or more the HUD, or?
I'm not interested in Filthy Riches yet because I want to use my own money, and I'm building my QRP up to fund these new acquisitions. I want to use my own money to get started and then go from there.
Yeah. That makes sense.
How about you? What are you doing?
Interestingly, I've been doing real estate for about 45 years.
Okay.
I've owned several hundred properties, mostly single families.
Okay.
And but I've managed over 45 years to have like bad timing, you know, like if you pick the four times over 45 years where it would be the worst time to own them, that's when I owned them. So I have, long story short is a lot of experience, but a lot of bad timing, a lot of bad management on my part, not having boots on the ground, checking things out. I did buy in 10 states or so. So I'm trying to figure out now, because all of that stuff I did is more older than recent, and you buy houses entirely differently than you do back then. At least being out here in California, it's more difficult, simply because it's basically a cash market out here, so you need big sums of cash to buy a house.
Yeah.
Starter houses are $400,000, you know.
Okay, gotcha.
And if it's got three bedrooms, it's probably $500,000. So I'm trying to figure out how to break in without having, you know, the big amounts of cash to do that.
Gotcha.
And so wondering if I haven't really wanted to go out of state, but figuring, oh, maybe I might have to.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I mean, with me doing business in California and my corporate position, I understand completely what you're saying.
Yeah. Actually, Bakersfield is one place I've been looking at somewhat, because prices are definitely less there than Southern Cal, because it's slightly out of Southern Cal, you know. So yeah. That's Central Valley, is part of potential place where it would be a good place to potentially buy.
Yeah, it's more industrial. It's more... you got the sweet spot of homes where people can buy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
At least that's what I saw when I visited our facility in Bakersfield.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Hey, guys, I got a question for you. It's Nathan here, and I wanted to ask you, are you both investing in California or have invested in California?
I have invested in California and about 10 other states. This is Norm. And I'm here, so I'm just trying to do California because I'm here.
And okay. The other guy, Nathan, is Ralph Bach. Okay. You know, we talked yesterday. I'm a newbie. I'm just getting started.
Hey, Ralph.
And I'm not intending to invest out that way. It's too far for me.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because actually a few investors in California – I have some clients that I'm working with, and they invest on the East Coast, like let's say Alabama or in the middle of the country, like Texas.
Right.
You know, let me ask you this. You've invested over in California. Would you recommend someone who's just starting out getting started in California?
Well, not unless they have a big pot of money, because you can't, You know, if you pay $400,000 for a house, you're not going to try to make a $5,000 profit, you know. And so by the time you do it, there's so much money chasing so few goods. All of the good ways of buying, HUD is almost non-existent. They don't have any kind of anything going out here very much. And the foreclosures, the banks are trying to get more than max, more than full price for them. And, you know, foreclosures have hedge funds buying everything up at 90 cents on the dollar. So all the real easy ways of doing properties are extremely competitive. So, you know, first day on the market, they're gone.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, because I know a lot of like new students like listen to these calls, by the way. So I know that will help actually anyone new coming in. They sometimes people who live in California are like, oh, should I?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
Hey, they already know. And like you said,
I'm Melody, Florida. I'm not sure if I'm on the right call. This is Larry Goins' call for property analysis.
Yeah.
This is a first time on the call.
Yeah, this is Nathan. Okay,
oh, Nathan.
Great. Yeah. So let me start off with this is Nathan. Let me start off with the introduction. So yes, everyone, I am Nathan. I do the deal analysis calls on the second Wednesday of the month, and then on the fourth Wednesday of the month, I do the buyer and seller calls for Larry Goins' Inner Circle. When I got on the call, I got jumped on the phone a bit late because I was having a hard time getting into the room. So there was a conversation already starting, but I'm here and we are doing the analyzation call for sure. So with that being said, who wants to go first? Who wants to go over a deal maybe that they have or they're having some trouble with or even maybe something that they've done recently? I'd love to kick it off that way.
I'll start off with I bought a property, again, I'm in California, so I bought a property in California, but kind of far out, like over the mountains, but still in California, and having trouble selling it. I've had it on the market for 120 days, and I've got it, I've dropped the price a couple times, but it just appears to be a property that, you know, 1 in 1,000 would want. And after I realized I probably shouldn't have bought the house in the first place. After I rehabbed it and I have it below market now and not get any action. Hard to sell.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and you've been doing this for a while, right?
I've been doing real estate for a lot of years and I should have known better, but I didn't.
Yeah. Do you just have the property listed on the retail market, like, you know, just like a realtor or something?
Craigslist and things like that.
Sure. Let me ask you this. Have you considered, like, selling it maybe a different way, like either owner financing, lease options, rent to own, that kind of thing?
Well, it's just I have. The problem is that that's kind of like my whole pot to work with is in the house. So, you know, I really would like to continue, and I really, you know, want to continue, you know, playing the game, but you need some money out here.
Right, I understand. Well, let me ask you this, because it's been on the market already for a while, right? So let me ask you this. If you were to check with an agent, the agent that has it listed, one, you could check the average days on market for retail sale in that area.
Yeah.
But also, if there's opportunity there, if you were to owner financing or lease option it, if there's enough money in the deal, you could end up, like, you know, getting a good chunk of down payment. So that would be some money there. Or if you do a lease option, you could do, you know, get an option, consideration money. I would say if you go the route of the owner financing and get the down payment, then you could sell the mortgage. That was kind of my thinking. Like, you could
sell
the mortgage to a note buyer, you know, if you're just looking for the cash, you know?
Yeah.
That might be an option, just because if you know, like, get with the agent first and see how long the typical house will sell in that market, you know what I mean?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's in a zip code that has a city maybe 15 miles away, and it's hard to get a days on the market number out of the agents.
Oh, okay.
And that turns out to be high, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So and to sell it on a sell it on a note and sell the note still brings you a lot less, you know, brings you a lot less cash to deal with. Because you have to either hold it for a number of months for it to season, or you sell it fast and you get you give somebody a good return, but then you don't get much cash.
Right. Yeah. So let me ask you this. What strategy of real estate are you, like, while that one's sitting and waiting, but what strategy of real estate are you doing right now?
I've been sitting waiting, and that's the problem. And like I said, I've done many, many different kinds of real estate as far as houses and so forth, but I either have to find another state to deal in or something, because, you know, almost nobody takes owner will carry out here. You know, there's not lease options to use. There's just too many things against it here. And obviously I should go where I can, but that's what I'm trying to figure out. If I need to find a place where I can deal, maybe do some wholesaling or something like that.
Right. Actually, I'm not sure if you were on the call last month, but I'll actually do a continuation of a story of an investor that we talked about on his deal that he actually closed. So we brought it up about what he got it for. We ran the numbers on the previous call, and you can check in the archives if you want to listen to it. But he's out in Los Angeles, but he invested in Alabama in a really just like a small town, not too far away from, I think about an hour away from Birmingham. But he knew that market, based on the agent, they said, hey, we can't even keep properties on the market. We need more inventory. So anyway, he got the property for like 60 to 70% below market value. Like, he got it for like 30 cents on the dollar. It was really cheap. He got it right off HUD, right at the end of the year. And the good thing is he ended up buying the deal, turning around. He actually used someone else's money. And I bring this part up for you, for example. He actually used private money to get into the deal. He cashed out $14,500, I think it was, at closing for himself. And then he turned around and he's going to sell it on retail. Retail, he's got a pre-approved person in the works, and he also has owner financing in the works. So he's got a few options there.
Yeah,
but he did that with no money out of his own pocket. So
maybe the first step
would be is to maybe check a different market, you know, start looking in a different market that would be maybe a little bit more flexible, or it doesn't need as much, you know, capital to get started with, and then either use other people's money or, you know, alternatives like wholesaling and stuff.
Yeah. I haven't been very successful in finding other private money, but I'm not an aggressive person going out trying to, you know, try to get people to invest. And I don't really have lots of moneyed friends or anything like that to do that. So it's kind of like, you know, trying to do it. And like I said, I've got all the experience in the world. I've bought over 100 properties without any money down in the past, but that's all old, 30 years ago type of thing.
Right. Okay. Well, if it helps any, I can just give you a tip here. I can give it to everyone here on the call, and it's something about, you know, raising money. It's something I pretty much do almost on a daily basis. I try to call at least two people every day, and because I enjoy raising private money. But what I tend to do is I like to call two people every day and just check on people. Like, hey, how's it going? How's life? How's business? Usually the call is about 30 minutes long. But when I do that, here's a little caveat that something that I do when I'm on the phone, when they ask me how my life is going and what I've been up to, because I already asked them, and that's kind of like how conversations go. So when they ask me back, I always say, hey, actually, I'm working on a project right now. Do you happen to know anyone? Right? That's the line I use. Do you happen to know anyone who would be interested in, and then you go into your opportunity. Sometimes I don't even have the deal lined up. Most of the time I just use the same lines over and over again. And it doesn't mean I have an opportunity ready on the table for them. But when they refer me someone, they say, oh, yeah, or I might have someone interested. But actually what's happening in their mind is they're thinking about if they're interested. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So that's something I've used over the years, and it works like a charm, man. It really does. So you might want to try that, and because you might not think like – I understand you might, your immediate circles might not have the money. However, they may know someone, and they can give you a referral to that person. And, you know, and that can be endless. That's an endless.
Keep going. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, so I would use that line, you know.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know someone that's interested? And see what they say.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. And just keep track. Like, one thing I like to use, I use an app on my phone and on my desktop. It's called Full Contact, F-U-L-L, contact. .com, or you can get it on the mobile device. But basically, it's a way to like track your contacts. And you really, whenever you're raising money or looking for cash buyers, for example, you really want to have a way to segment your list and know how much they have. So when a project comes along, you can easily search for them by how much money they have, like the type of deal that you're trying to that you can have for them. Yeah. So instead of like looking through a whole list and like, oh, I don't know, I can't remember who has what, right? That kind of thing. So
yeah.
Hopefully that helps for you.
Thank you.
Nathan, question on that approach. You know,
sure.
Someone like me that's only bought two properties, I got a self-directed IRA. You know, the first question the guy asked is, you know, what experience you have? How do you respond to that positively when you're going through that network that you talked about?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question because I've done this same strategy with people who've never, like my clients, some of them have never done a deal before, and they've used that same line. Here's the thing. When someone talks about an offer, when you're talking about the opportunity and they say how much experience you have, you can do this in a few ways. One, this is what I tell my clients, okay? And you could probably say the same thing for your clients. You could just say, hey, me and my business partner. Now, if you've been in the inner circle, I would just use Larry or myself as your imaginary business partner. We don't have to be on your LLC documents or anything, but you can just kind of lean on our expertise. You know what I mean? You could say, yeah, well, I've done a bunch of deals, but my business partner has done many more deals, right? So, or you can say mentor, however you want to phrase it. When I'm working with a client, I tell them to use me as their imaginary business partner. So like as if I'm right there beside them. So they just tell their clients, say, hey, listen, me and my business partner, we've done this, this, and this, and here's the deal, right? And I've had a lot of clients of mine who have raised money on their very first deal. So just keep that in mind because even if you want to position it that way, whether it's, you know, leaning on Larry or leaning on myself, either way, you can use that. And then even if you needed me, because I think you're in the program, so even if you need me to jump on the phone and help you raise some money, I have no problem doing that as well. Because we'll be working together. So
yeah, that's a good point because Larry has mentioned that during the inner circle training. So that's a good point. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think, and regardless, just for general sense, whether it's Larry, myself, or even someone in the future that you come across, you know, there's a word in marketing they use. It's called borrowed credibility. It's a marketing term. And basically
what's the term?
What you're doing is like, it's called borrowed credibility.
Okay.
Borrowed credibility. Yeah, it's like if you ever see someone like taking a picture with like a famous person, or you know, you see someone standing next to someone who's a famous business person, and they use that in their presentation, that's called borrowed credibility. So it's basically like, hey, look, I'm associated with this person or associated with this company. And when you're using that in a presentation for an opportunity, it just brings that credibility out even more. It's almost like people forget about you in a way, and they're all like, wow, you're associated with that person? They almost, in a way, kind of forget about you in a way. But it helps. It helps in the presentation.
Very good.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the next question.
Nathan, you mentioned you used an app on your phone called fullcontact.com.
Yeah.
Is that F-U-L-L?
Yeah, F-U-L-L-C-O-N-T-A-N-T, fullcontact.com. It's on the, you can look it up if you have an Android phone or if you have an iPhone. You can look it up on right on the mobile app store. It has a red icon and a little person silhouette on it. Yeah, that's just an app I use. And here's the reason why I use it and why I like it so much, whether you use that one or any other. But the reason why I like it is it has a feature called tagging. And tagging is basically you can add almost like a – well, it's a tag, but imagine adding like a sticky note in the physical sense. You're adding like a sticky note to them, a digital sticky note, with how much – whatever you want to say like about that person. For example,
yeah.
I have tags for accountants, bankers, lawyers, real estate appraisers, right? I have tags for different – like – I have like over 60 something tags, I think it is, like 68. And what I do is when I get a new contact, I will add a tag to that person. But a lot of my tags, when it comes to raising money or cash buyers, most of the time, I don't have a whole bunch of cash buyers, but because I don't do a lot of wholesaling anymore. But a lot of private money people that I have, the way I label them in a tag is I label them by like a range of how much money they have. So I'll do like, you know, 50,000 and below will be one tag. 50,000 and above will be another tag. 100,000 and above is another tag. Yeah, like that. It can actually. There is an extension on Chrome and Firefox. You can actually have it integrated in your email. I think it's a free extension. It automatically syncs right to your email as well. Yeah, and I use Full Contact. I don't know if anyone else has had this problem, but I have contacts in my phone and then in my Gmail account and then in my business account. So what it does, and this is actually the problem that it first solved for me, was it synced all the contact management system, right? Because I would have like some contacts over here and some contacts over there. So it kind of like syncs them all together. And another cool thing it does, it actually searches social media and public profiles and kind of gathers data on the person when you add them to the system, and it automatically updates them in your contact records. So if someone changed their Facebook information, it would actually automatically update it inside of your app, inside of the Full Contact app for you.
And, you know, I hate to ask you one more time. For some reason, the connection is not good. Can you spell the name of that app again?
Sure. It's FullContact. Full Contact.
TACT. You know, Hi, Nathan. This is Sarah. Yeah, actually, I punch in the URL, and the icon I got is a red, but it does not have an I. And then this one has pricing is free for 100 matches, and then it's like $99 a month with 2,500. Is this the one you're talking about?
No, that's not the one at all, actually. No, it's actually a free app, and if they have a premium version, if you have like over 25,000 contacts, it's fullcontact.com, F-U-L-L-C, listen to, if you shoot me an email at nathan@larrygoins.com, I will email it to you. I can just email it to you.
Yeah, because it doesn't show up.
I'll send it to you. So, yeah, you can just email me at Nathan, which is N-A-T-H-A-N, @larrygoins.com, and then I will send it over to you.
Okay, great.
Yeah, no problem. All right. Does anyone else want to go over a deal that they maybe saw or haven't analyzed yet or maybe want to analyze?
I have a question. Using the Filthy Riches model, I just put in four offers for HUD houses. Now, you're saying one of the calls that I was on said to go ahead and shoot off the request, the offer, and then analyze them afterwards. I'm trying to cut back on time element, doing too much research. So,
right.
Now, those be something that you would want to analyze in case I come back today, an offer accepted?
Yeah, I mean, so let me just make sure I understand you correctly. You're saying you're having a problem like overanalyzing deals, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How much time per deal, like per property, would you say that you're spending, like doing research on?
Probably 15 minutes, 20, 30.
Okay. Okay. Well, so I would just say
go ahead.
I would say if you could keep it probably under like definitely 30, if you could keep it in the 10 to 15, 10 to 20 range, that should be good. And what can help, let me dive into two things, because first you mentioned HUD, so let me hit that first. Now, when it comes to HUD, it's really just a matter of submitting those bids. I mean, that's really, you don't have to go into too much detail with HUD because it's just a more of a bidding basis, and you can set your criteria and just, you could actually delegate that. This is what Larry talks about. You can delegate that entire job to a virtual assistant, let's say, and as long as you give them that criteria, they can go in there and just make those bids every day until one gets accepted, right? So that's one model. Then you can analyze it after, okay? That's one model. However, if you're not bidding on HUD, right, what would be important is as you're in looking in a market, as you're looking at properties and analyzing properties in the market, you kind of want to find a market that's going to be very in a very concentrated area so that you're not getting all different types of properties in order to submit the offer. For example, you want to find, if you're doing a Filthy Rich's house, right, like these Filthy Rich's, maybe modular or manufactured homes or properties that are under 100,000, you really want to get in a neighborhood or in a few neighborhoods that you know pretty much all have the same kind of house values. And then you just start submitting offers in those areas. This way you can say, okay, I know all these properties in this area and this market are all going to be pretty much under 100,000. So you can pretty much be safe to say like you're going to start submitting your offers and not waste so much time. It's just, the offer is just to see if they're ready to, like, you know, to come back and to do a counter offer if they're ready to play. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah. So with those two different models, like if you're going to go with HUD, you know, it's going to be just set your criteria and that percentage that you're going to be at for each property. And then when you're doing it, whether it's motivated sellers or foreclosures, if you pick, it's helpful if you pick a specific market so that you can submit a lot of offers in that same area rather quickly if you're going to be doing a lot of offers. Or, for example, are you working with an agent by chance? Are you submitting offers through an agent?
Yes.
Okay. So that's another example. Like if you were to get with an agent and to give them like a certain amount of criteria, you know, you say, hey, I'm looking for a house with, you know, 3-bed, 2-bath, a minimum of 1,200 square feet, and so on and so forth with that price range. You could say, hey, find me a bunch of these properties and let's submit offers, right? You can submit offers about whatever your percentage is for your that type of property. So typically for,
that's what confuses me a little bit. When you say you're working with an agent and say you bid on it, and then you get it, but you don't have that agent that you're working with up front be the listing to sell it. You try to sell it yourself, but how do you get an agent to work with you, and he asks, can I list it for you if you get it?
Sure. So you're saying, I think I understand you correctly here, you're saying if you bid the house with a listing agent and then they want to relist it with you after you buy it?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, actually this just came up with another client of mine that I'm working with, that he bought the property and she's been really, really helpful But he has to make the, you know, she's getting paid on the close of the deal. However, she's like, hey, can I relist it for you after you're done with either your rehab or whatever you do? Can I relist it for you? And you simply have to just come out and say it. Say, hey, listen, this property, in this case, as in this example, hey, on this property, I'm not going to rehab it. I'm actually just going to turn around and sell it, but I'm going to see how I can sell it on my own because I really need to build my buyers list. However, if you have some cash buyers or buyers for this type of property, then maybe we can, if you bring me a buyer, maybe I can list it with you and you can get the you can do the transaction and get paid on it. So I would just say it that way. Like when you're dealing with an agent, you really don't want to sign an exclusivity for a long period of time because they usually try to do that. That's just their way of protecting their commissions. But what you can do is you can sign, if you want, an exclusivity just for that piece of property. So if you find a buyer, whoever finds the buyer first, if your agent finds the buyer first, then you just say, hey, if you find the buyer and you bring it, then we'll put you on the paperwork and you get paid.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And then, but I guess the getting them to work with you, you should probably pay them, you know, $50 or something to help you, or there's got to be some kind of fee they would want, or how does that work? No?
Well, okay, this is, you can pay them fees. However, you can't pay them a bonus after you close. I think federal law says you can only give them like a $25 gift card for a referring or for a bonus and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
However, if an agent charges for their time or service, such as if they're going to go take pictures for you, stuff like that, they can charge a service fee. Now, there's a lot of agents out there that do that. So that's really up to you. It depends what you're having them do, though. I mean, if they're just going to pull, like, a CMA for you, that should be free. That's kind of like – that should be part of the relationship, you know, pulling CMAs. If they are going to go take pictures for you and videos on your behalf, put out signs on your behalf, then I would definitely consider compensating them unless you have a really great relationship and they're willing to do anything for you, you know. But I would still compensate someone who's going to drive out there, put up signs, take pictures, whether it's an agent or not an agent. You should have some form of compensation in there. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Sure, sure. And to add to that, you know, sometimes the best agents to work with when you're submitting offers is an agent who's already – like in the business working with investors, it's a lot difficult to work with an agent who is mostly like listing houses, you know, they trying to get a bunch of listings, maybe even doing it part-time. What you really want is what I call an investor-friendly agent, right? You want someone who is experienced with other investors. Sometimes you find them at the local investment clubs, the local RIA meetings, or you get a referral from another investor, that kind of thing. So those really help because they understand the business from your mind, from your eyes. Does that make sense?
So you got to, find the right agent. You may not be dealing with the right real estate agent if he doesn't have that kind of experience and know-how.
Yeah, it's very true. Actually, the statistics are, I think it was Keller Williams that put the statistics out, or Century 21, one of them. But they said, you know, they did a bunch of research, and they do it every year, actually, that, you know, most of the agents in the country are part-time. Not all of them work full-time. They're just part-time. Most of them do it on the weekends. And if you were to, and most of them list retail, most of them don't work with investors. So that percentage just keeps getting more and more narrow. That's why I said if you can get an agent that either goes to a local investment club meetings or a RIA group meetings, or you get a referral from another investor that is actively doing the business like yourself, then you're probably going to have a better chance of getting a good realtor. Does that make sense?
Yes. I got a question on the calculation of the ARV.
Okay.
You get a property, you do your homework, you know, you get, you know, go to Homes, HomeSnap, Redfin, Realtor, Reappraisal, Zillow, whatever, and you get their estimates, and then you average it out. So you get a like a third party. I call it a third party average. And then you go through Zillow, and you get four properties that are in the same square footage. You know, the range. I usually go -15%, +15% to get homes apples to apples. And then I get the average value of that, or I get it down to an average cost per square foot. And with the ARV, those prices, with the ARV, without getting, you know, a good rehab cost, you know, for whatever reason, you can't get a contractor inside the home or whatever, with a good rule of thumb, have the ARV somewhere in between the third-party average and the average price per square foot? If you know.
This is a good question. This is a good question because I know there's different ways of thought when it comes to how do we find the value of a property, okay?
Right.
Some people just go off the square. Some people go off square footage, and some people actually get the actual, like the third party sources. Square footage can be a little tricky. It's more advantageous. Usually rehabbers do that. Having properties, they typically go by square footage because they're actively rehabbing. They know things down to, you know, by price and square foot. They're buying materials that way as well. Here's the thing. What I would recommend is your other approach, and I'll add a little bit to that, is you're doing the apples to apples, oranges to oranges, right? Comparative analysis. So you are finding other properties, whether it's through third-party, you know, public record, third-party sources, and you're gathering that data. Another two additional ways, and this is like, I'll tell you the way I would do a descending order, right, of how to find the best way to find the value of a property. Number one is an appraisal, right? That's the number one best way. Okay.
Right.
However, because we're investors and we're not moving into these properties and we're not going to get appraisals and pay $350 for every appraisal here, even if we're not going to buy the property, we kind of avoid that one. And we skip to the next one, which is going to be the CMA, the comparative market analysis. That's going to be your second best bet because while you're doing the CMA, right, while your agent is pulling up the CMA for you, you can go to your third-party sources, right? So that would be third-party sources are going to be number three, okay, your third option. So while your agent in the number two spot is pulling out a CMA for you, you can also get a BPO at the same time from your agent, right? You can also get a broker price opinion and see what they think of the property. That's just their opinion, but you go, again, that's going to be based on experience. Try to be careful with that, by the way. BPOs can be a little tricky. If your agent is not that experienced, so they're fairly new, your BPOs probably should have less value. If they're really experienced and really good, then you could probably use more weight on that there's a little bit more of validity on that BPO. The CMA would be your second best bet, then third-party sources. So while your agent's pulling out the CMA, you can do your you can pull up values through third-party sources. However, if you are – this is where this gets interchanged. If you are, just kind of looking in the market for properties, like you're just analyzing a market and values before you even make your offer – then you're probably going to interchange number two and number three. You're probably going to move those around and say, okay, hey, let me go to third-party sources first before I get a CMA. So those are interchangeable. But I would say if you kind of use those as your base, that one, two, three, ascending order like that, that's going to be pretty solid to get you a good value on the property. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because if you're trying to get an ARV from a realtor, you know, the normal response, you know, I'm just getting started analyzing it, but the normal response in my mind would be, well, it depends on the amount of repairs you do, you know, and and you, if you can't get somebody in the house to do a rehab at the time, like with Larry, when we were at the Inner Circle, he goes to Zillow and he does his filters and he gets his candidates and he calls the realtor. and he makes an offer or tries to make an offer that day when he's on the phone, and then do his due diligence, you know, the 15-day due diligence after he, if he gets an offer accepted, you know, that's when you get the actual CMA.
Right, right.
So, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And Larry brings up a good point, and I'll tell you something. I always bring this up. Some people, and that's a great method, by the way, it is. Some people are always not ready for that. Like, let me make an offer now on that first call. That is
right.
Something you should definitely aspire to. You should aspire to that, and I'll tell you why. Because when you're calling the agent and you already have that confidence, like, hey, I want to make an offer now.
Right.
Right? I'm making an offer right now while I'm on the phone with you. All that does to the agent is bring, like, a whole level of credibility to the table. Like, okay, this guy's serious. Like, he's going to make an offer. So he's making an offer right now. So you submit that offer there, and then now you just took the first swing at the tennis match. That's what you've done. You took the first swing, you hit that tennis ball over, and you're waiting for it to come back. Because in wholesaling or any kind of real estate, but I'm saying, like, in, after that first offer, that the negotiation is where the deals are created. You know,
right.
Great deals are not found, they're created. So when you're submitting that offer, you're just showing your interest, and then you got to get them to come back, and then you go back and forth from there. You could do your due diligence after you see if there's a counteroffer. If there's a counteroffer, now you're seeing some motivation there, right? So
yeah.
that helps. And then from there, you go under contract, you go through your inspection period, and your inspection period is where your negotiation skills come up even again to help bring down the price even more. Well, most of the time. I don't want to say every time, because sometimes you could already be getting a good deal, but most of the time you use the inspection period to help you get even a better price on the deal.
Right. But that's what I got to overcome, because you know, the woman there, I like to spend an hour due diligence before I even get on the phone. That's what I got to overcome. You can't do that.
Right. Yeah. You know, you totally got to shrink that down. My wife thinks I'm crazy because I literally will go up to a property and I'll be right there with the seller and I'll just start making offers right there. She's like, don't you want to look around first? You know? And the reality is, I want you to just put in your mind, this is what I tell a lot of people that I work with, just put in your mind that inside of your contract is your exit clauses. Because after you go and be skeptical, and when you walk into the property, whether it's you or your contractors, you have your exit clauses to get out, right? So most of the beginning part of the whole making offer part is just to see, hey, how interested are you? How motivated are you, right? Even if they say motivated seller, or they call one of your marketing pieces, a yard sign or an ad, or they go to your website, you still have to kind of qualify them. You have to hear their story of how motivated are they, right? And that's where the game begins. So your offer kind of just gets the ball rolling. And to add to that about making offers, this is what I tell everybody. I said, listen, if you're just getting started, you got to know your first 10 offers, you're not going to even get it. You're not going to even get a deal out of your first 10 offers. It always happens after, because it just kind of gets the initial, butterflies out of there. You know what I mean? It just kind of pushes them away and say, okay, the first offer is not going to get accepted. Second one's not going to, but you have to get past 10 in order to get, you know, some good traction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, understood. That's the part
yeah.
I got to overcome.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, just, you know, one thing, I'll tell you one thing. When I was in Larry's office back in 2011. I was recruiting some acquisition managers. What we did was we bought a few. What are they? Those cooking timers? I don't even know if they still sell those anymore. But you know, they have the cooker timers that just tick away, or you can do one right on your phone. Just time yourself, and you know, either turn on the cooker timer or turn on your phone and do a stopwatch, and just say, okay, as soon as this clock ends, you know, that means I have to make an offer. I'm done. I got to move on, right? So that way, if you're looking at a property too, you don't look at a property too long, because you could analyze a deal to death. I mean, and just be like, oh, that deal, that's not a deal. You won't really know it's a deal until you find out motivation. Does that make sense?
Yep, understood.
Cool. I would just say use a stopwatch on your phone because I'm digital. I just recommend digital. I want to go out buy a cooker timer if I'm you. Say it. Good stuff. All right. What's that's the next question. What else do we got?
Oh, I had at this point. Like I said, right. I'm just getting started.
Sure. Are you, by the way, are you starting off wholesaling real estate, or what's your strategy to start off with?
Yeah, I'm looking at, I got four. I'm looking at tax deeds, tax lien certificates, wholesaling,
sure.
And HUD homes.
Sure, okay. Yes. Yeah, so,
hey, Nathan, I got a question.
Whichever strategy. Yep. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I have a question, and this is Norm again in California, and I'm considering that I need to find a different location. And, of course, that leaves everywhere open. To me, obviously, it would be better to be closer to California than it would be to Alabama. And so I'm wondering, how would you, looking at trying to, instead of looking at the deal, looking at how would you choose the market you would want to choose?
That's a great question that comes up often. A great question. Have you ever heard anyone say, invest in a place where you would love maybe to visit often? Have you ever heard someone say
live
that?
In a place what?
I've even heard. Like I've heard investors say, even when I was coming up in the real estate business, they would always say, invest in a place where you wouldn't mind visiting. Like, for example,
uh-huh.
If you owned an apartment complex, you wouldn't mind, going to your apartment complex, living there, making a tax write-off, that kind of thing, right?
Right, okay.
So here's what I say. Find a place that gets you really, that you're really excited about, like that you absolutely love, that you'd buy the T-shirt, you'd buy the hat that says the city's name. I'll give you an example. I absolutely love Charlotte, North Carolina. If I was to live anywhere in the United States, I would live, again, in Charlotte, North Carolina. I would buy the T-shirt, I'd buy the hat, and I would love and learn and be in that area. Because I'll tell you why. If you're going to invest in this in real estate, you're going to be in this business. The hardest part about this business is not so much real estate, it's our mindset. That's the hardest part, is our mind. So what really helps us get through the day-to-day about this business is having a positive and excited mindset. Well, what helps along the way, what I found that helps, is when you're excited about a market, it kind of makes it a bit easier. You have no problem like getting to know what's going on, hearing the local news, hearing about developments that are going on, job growth coming in, that kind of stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear it.
Yeah.
It seems like that's kind of automatic to me, everything you said there. But, I live in California because of the weather, but that's what I'm trying to do is find a place outside of where I want to live.
Right. I understand. Yeah, it may be a place you love to live. It may be a place that you would like to travel to, that you like to go visit often.
I'm trying to think of a place where it's easier to make deals.
Well, here's the reality, though. You can do deals in every state, right? I mean, the reality is there's real estate everywhere. There's real estate all over the country. And you can do different strategies in different states, right? You can do all kinds of strategies in every different state. Now, if you want to say, hey, I want to be in, a much more busier area, right, where I can do more deals, then you'd probably stay out of the central United States, right? More farmland there, not a whole lot of deals going on there, right? So you probably stay out of the center of the United States. But if you were to pick, let's say, any major metropolitan in any state, you know, then you would say, okay, well, do you like the northern states? Do you like snow? Probably not, right? So
actually, it's okay.
The whole northern part of it. You like it? Okay, yeah. See, some if you enjoy something about it, then do that, because it's just going to help the process. I mean, because listen, you can get a deal. For example, let's look at Detroit, right? Let's look at Detroit. Some
right.
people look at Detroit and they say, oh my God, I wouldn't invest there. That place is backwards. Like, it boarded up, buildings down. However, some investors absolutely love it. They love that kind of environment, right?
Right.
After, let's say, if you remember Hurricane Katrina, some people were like, oh my gosh, I'm not investing there. And then there was a whole bunch of other investors that were like, they all flocked down there. They opened up offices down there, right? Because they liked that opportunity, right? So
right.
keep that in mind. It's really all about what gets you excited, because there's nothing worse than being investing in a place where your heart is not connected to it. I mean, look at it this way. If you were to take $10,000 and to put it in some kind of like stock, I mean, would you put it in something that you have no clue about, or would you put it in something that you might have a clue about or enjoy, right?
Right.
Kind of like the same thing. You're going to do something that you enjoy, that you wouldn't mind reading the news about it, right? That Warren Buffett says it like this. He says, Warren Buffett says, I'm not diversified. He's not. He has many different companies and whatnot, but Warren Buffett, when he studies something that he's going to go into, he completely immerses himself in that one industry. And he reads all about it, studies it, it interests him. He gets that interest. And that's really what it is. It's a great strategy. It's a great investment strategy. So, again, there's all kinds of opportunities. There's some places that are really run down. Do you like that kind of environment? There's some places that are up and coming and are super, super, super busy. Let's say like Seattle, Washington, right? All kinds of markets, Los Angeles. Do you like that kind of environment? So find something that kind of gets you excited about the market. That really helps.
I don't think that doesn't – it's not a personal appeal to me to think that way. I think maybe because in my case, when I used to buy houses 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was buying a house a month, and what was fun was just going out and buying houses. But, you know, because it was, let's say, easier then. You know, people were don't wanters and that kind of thing. But in this market now where everybody wants what their house is worth plus a little bit more, it makes it harder to deal.
Well, right. That's because we're in a seller's market, right? That's just because we're in a seller's market. So it's a little bit – if you're going into a major city, it's going to be very competitive. Whether it's Boston, Charlotte, Orlando, right? Those are the competitive markets. They're very, very busy, very competitive. So
yeah, I want less competitive, but good.
Right, okay. So if you want less competitive, you can literally just take a major metropolitan city and you just draw a line. You've got to draw a line about over 30 miles out of that city, right? If
right.
depending on your strategy, wholesaling real estate, I think that's what you were talking about. So if you're talking about wholesaling, then you're probably going to draw a line maybe within 30 miles of that major city, right?
Right.
30 to 60 miles, not too far out. So, yeah, you might go a little bit more outside of the city, but still in the area that you kind of like, you know, that you have interest in.
Yeah, okay. That's one of the ones I have on my list right now, 30 miles outside the city. So you don't have quite the high prices, but it still has people that can commute and do that. But I'm looking for
that's
other
right.
things that might do that. Might be.
Well, sure. Let me give you another example. There's a place in New Jersey called Camden, New Jersey, right?
Mm-hmm,
this
right.
is more of like an emerging market. Camden, New Jersey is actually probably one of the top five worst places to live in. It's right around like as bad as Chicago, okay?
Yeah.
But it's a much more depressed area. However, just over the bridge is Philadelphia. Right? So just over the bridge is Philadelphia. And now there's a whole bunch of jobs that are being created. There's been about 50 companies that have gotten corporate tax breaks so that they can move in. And there's a whole bunch of rehabbing going on in that market. Whole bunch of rehabbing.
Yeah.
Now, you have to ask yourself, do you like dealing with boarded up houses that you can get for $3,000? Do you like that kind of environment? If you don't, then you're going to say, okay, that's not my type of environment. And that will steer you in a different direction, right?
Yeah.
So once you get clear on the type of property that you like, or, you know, what you want the property to look like, I would say maybe similar ones that you've done before, you're probably going to want to look in those neighborhoods that kind of match what you're looking for. And they're there. They are out there for sure. They may not be downtown or in a 20-mile radius, but you may have to go outside a little bit more. Yeah, especially in seller's markets.
Okay.
When you, by the way, when you bought those other 100 properties, where were they in California?
Well, I bought about 100 in California and maybe another 250 in 10 other states.
Okay.
But I'm going back to the mid-80s, just as it was coming out of the, you know, 17% interest rates, and I was buying Fannie Mae repos. So it was easy.
Okay, so you were following.
I'd buy 5 or 10 houses at a time from a lender. But you can't do that really much anymore. At least I don't seem to find it. Seems like there's too many people doing that. Or I used to go to foreclosure sales.
Yeah. You were following basically like foreclosure market, the foreclosure market. You'd go to any state that you could find a deal, right?
Yeah, I used to say I could find a deal anywhere within 3 weeks' time. I can find a deal, nothing down deal to buy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, but yeah.
I was going to say, that's fine. As you know, it's a strategy. And that probably got you excited, the no money down.
Right.
That took you all over the place. It took you 10 states. So, again, that kind of just brings up my point of find something that excites you. It may be the location. It may be the strategy.
Yeah, I think strategy would be more, and I'm just trying to find something that's, you know, not the boarded up house. But I would say, you know, less fix up. You know, but in a decent, not a C neighborhood, but maybe a C plus neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yep. So I'm trying to find. Yeah. Well, California's just too. It's just too high. Yeah, there's too much money out here.
California. Yeah, if you're in California, there's some great places in like Arizona. Like Arizona's not too far from you. New Mexico.
Yeah.
Right? You got Nevada. There's some
great places. So where do you know places in Arizona that are good?
Mesa is an up-and-coming area. Mesa. A lot of rehabbing going on there. Right? It's not Phoenix, right?
It's right next door. It is Phoenix, actually,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
I own a lot of properties there in, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But, okay, so... And yeah, out west, so, you know, your places you can think of. I know you're on the East Coast, but out west, can you give any places that you would think of that would be good?
Like I said, if you were to take, let's just talk about Phoenix for an example. If you were to take Phoenix and you were to draw a line on the map 30 miles out, it's going to give you, like, Chandler,
right?
Mesa, right?
And yeah, that's just what I just did the other day. So, yeah, exactly what you're thinking, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're on the right track then. Then start looking at those markets on the outskirts. They're up and coming. They're being a lot of rehabbing going on, you know. So if you're going to be doing wholesaling, that's a good place to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah, no problem. All right. All right, everyone. So if you have any additional questions about anything that I've mentioned, you can feel free to email me at nathan@larrygoins.com, and I'll get your questions or anything that you wanted to add. You can just shoot an email there. Our next call is the buyer and seller call, and that is going to be on the fourth Wednesday of the month, same time, same place. All right. It was great chatting with you, and I look forward to chatting with you real soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, Nathan.
All right. Have a good day. All right. Bye-bye.